This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's 2016. Time to get back to the office. We'll listen back to three conversations with actors from the hit show. Cambridge native Mindy Kaling.
This is my most favorite thing I've ever done.
About working at the office.
No, talking about myself.
Talking. A.K.A. Kelly Kapoor.
I can't control what I say to people. I spend the whole day talking.
Kelly's boyfriend, Ryan Howard.
If I had to, I could clean out my desk in 5 seconds. And nobody would ever know I had ever been here.
A.K.A. Newton native B.J. Novak.
That was the one compliment I tended to get, is that I was funny.
And...
Wow, these people here. There's too many people on this earth. We need a new plague.
Rainn Wilson.
Wherever I went, people would be like, oh my God, look, it's Dwight.
It's Radio Boston.
Oh, hey, it's Dwight. I love you. Oh my God, you're so funny. Can I have my picture? You're amazing. Oh.
First, the news. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy 2016. It's just a couple more days until it's time to get back to the daily grind, and for many of us, that means back to the office. That place of weird coworkers, desperate attention-seeking bosses, the sublime drudgery of interminable meetings and team-building workshops, the laughable, ludicrous, outrageous, ordinary office.
I think an ordinary paper company like Dunder Mifflin was a great subject for a documentary. There's a lot of beauty in ordinary things.
No one captured that bizarre beauty better than NBC's Emmy Award-winning comedy, The Office. The mockumentary ran from 2005 to 2013, and you just heard actress Jenna Fischer playing Pam Beasley in a moment of touching sincerity from the series finale there. The workaday drones from Scranton, Pennsylvania, earned legions of fans for so many reasons. Most notably, we could all recognize our own offices in the satire of Dunder Mifflin. And because of the pitch-perfect deadpan delivered by many of the show's brightest stars, The Office launched the careers of so many actors. And interestingly, a bunch of them have strong Massachusetts connections. There's Acton's Steve Carell, Cambridge's Mindy Kaling, Newton's B.J. Novak, and Rainn Wilson, who spent time at Tufts University. So today, in preparation for your return to The Office, we're going to listen back to three conversations we've had with those actors, beginning with Mindy Kaling, who played the gossipy, celebrity-obsessed Kelly Kapoor.
Oh my God, I have so much to tell you!
Really?
Yes, Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, they had a baby and they named it Surrey. And then Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, they had a baby too and they named it Shiloh. And both babies are amazing!
Great. What's new with you?
I just told you.
Kaling wrote 23 episodes of The Office, one of which earned her an Emmy nomination. And in 2012, she launched The Mindy Project, now in its fourth season. We spoke with Mindy Kaling in December of 2011, following the publication of her first book, Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? And Other Concerns. Just 1 month later, Mindy Kaling's mother died of pancreatic cancer. And Kaling didn't talk about her mother's illness with us, but she did tell us a lot about how her acting success could not have happened without her parents' steadfast support.
I've been so lucky because my parents are really my best friends and have been that way pretty much since I went to college. I mean, when I was younger, I was terrified of them because they're both, you know, disciplinarians and very serious-minded people, but they have great senses of humor, loved watching Seinfeld with me, let me stay up and watch Saturday Night Live, and they never wanted me to become a doctor, an architect, or engineer, which is what my family all is. Like, but there's no comedy writers or actors on either side of my family. But they were always like, sure, if you can do it, then do it. Yeah, they show up in my book a lot. Like, maybe, like, too much, but they're a huge part of my life.
Well, and you get along with them, too. So, I mean, that's the thing that really struck me is that so many comedians, they use their family as sort of this negative fuel for their comedy, but that doesn't seem to be you at all.
No, you know, my mom's an OBGYN.
So you called her a gossip that does pap smears.
You know, my brother said that. So I distanced myself from that remark. But I did think it was funny. But my mom's an OBGYN, so she's sort of seen everything, which is really nice because she's not very traditional, which I think is great. And my dad is an architect, but he's an incredibly adventurous guy. I mean, they've been on The Office. They were up to acting on the show, which I thought was pretty great.
Well, tell me a little bit about what your high school life was like, because that's where you opened the book. And you went to Buckingham Brown and Nichols,
yeah,
a school, obviously, here in the area. And just tell listeners, how do you describe yourself as a high school student?
I was a bright kid. I wasn't the brightest kid. And I knew that I wanted to perform. I loved performing. But at our high school, even though it was in a really great, rigorous prep school in Cambridge, we didn't have like an improv troupe or a playwriting program because it was just a high school. So I didn't really know how I wanted to do this. And I would audition every year, get my hopes up to be a lead in the play, and never once was ever the lead in any play. And didn't really have like any solos in any of our like singing groups or anything. So like there was nothing there that really said like you could go into this professionally. But it wasn't really until I got to college where I found that kind of confidence.
Well, so even though you didn't necessarily get the direct encouragement to consider comedy as a professional career, I mean, did you have a sense when you were in high school that you were funny?
I always kind of thought I was funny. Like, I always, like, which is, I guess I'm certain I wasn't funny. Because, like, nobody who eventually ends up being professionally funny was probably funny in high school. They're most likely the kids who end up being funny are the ones that, like, love comedy and are watching it all the time. So they're actually more just, like, the creepy nerds who are always talking about Kids in the Hall or always talking about Saturday Night Live because it's important to them. But you don't really get your own voice, I don't think, till later. If kids are funny when they're teenagers, I happen to believe that it's probably because it's unintentional. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when I see these kids in high school doing stand-up comedy, I'm like, what? This is so weird. Just grow up. Like, find out, like, be normal. Find out what you, like, are, who you are, and then just do it later.
I'm speaking with Mindy Kaling. She is an actress and writer and one of the executive producers from The Office. She is also a Cambridge native, and her new book is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me and Other Concerns. Let me ask you about that title and high school. I mean, were you worried that people were hanging out without you?
Oh, I knew that they were. I mean, I didn't. That is almost like the title is like even too giving myself too much credit. Like, there was legions of cool. And the thing about BBNN, which was extra frustrating, was that it wasn't like there was the jocks and they were so cool, but they weren't good at school. The popular kids were like on the varsity soccer team, and they had gotten like a 1600 on the SAT. Like, that was the kind of school it was. So you couldn't even be like, yeah, they're a dumb jock. Wait till you're like, oh, they're going to Princeton. Okay, they're actually really accomplished student and like and everything else. So that was kind of the minor hell that was called high school, I mean.
But nevertheless, you write really, humorously, maybe a quality of your writing is that it's difficult to tell what might be actually your real experience versus just pure comedy, because you have a section in one of the chapters about life in high school where you talk about how the John Cougar Mellencamp song Jack and Diane is one that you really don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Then tell people why it is that you don't like it.
Well, I mean, the thing about that song is that it really fetishizes, I would say, yeah, I'm going to say fetishizes, a very a high school experience that is, in my mind, can only be lived by really attractive white teenagers who are not studying, who are not at home helping their parents out, who are just being, like, idle and, you know, like they hang out behind the Tasty Freeze or something. They just are loitering and just, I think, being bad kids and having sex and stuff. Like, and I just, and then the song, the lyric of the song that has always struck me as so sad, as he goes, but he's like, oh yeah, life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? That's what you consider the thrill of living, is hanging out in a parking lot? So if you weren't popular and you weren't being somehow, your parents didn't care where you were after school, and you sort of listen to that song, and it's just like, wow, I feel completely devalued.
Mm-hmm. And you write that the song, instead of Jack and Diane, the one that you would request if it existed would be a little ditty about a hardworking Vietnamese girl who helps her parents with the franchise Holiday Inn they run and does homework in the lobby, and including a character named Ari, a hardworking Jewish boy who does volunteer work at his grandmother's old age home, and they meet after school at Princeton Review.
Yeah, these are my people. Like, I mean, that's hardworking ethnic kids with chips on their shoulders. Like, that's what I, that's who I want to be around. I want my kids to be like that, I guess.
So you graduated from BBNN and then went to Dartmouth.
Went to Dartmouth, yeah.
And was it there, as you were hinting earlier, that you really realized comedy was this thing that you could do, and you could do it well, and maybe even do it as a profession?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So what happened?
Well, I started auditioning for things and then kind of getting them. I got to feel like a cool kid because I was actually succeeding and stuff.
Mindy Kaling, let's fast forward a little bit to when you moved to New York City, because it was there that you wrote, or co-wrote, I should say, Matt and Ben, and a play about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. And give us a little bit of the synopsis of what this play was about.
So the play was a very short play. It's about 50 minutes long. It's a one act. And it's a very absurd, and it's a really weird play. The not the weirdest part of it, actually, is that I'm playing Ben Affleck, and my best friend Brenda, who wrote the play with me, is playing Matt Damon. Now, to make it even stranger, Brenda is like 5'10", and like a very like thin, willowy girl with like long blonde hair. She went to Dartmouth with me, actually. Where she's still my best friend. I saw her last week, and I played Ben Affleck, who is the sort of taller one of the two. So that was also very confusing. But it was a very absurd play, and the tone of it was, I say in the book, it was like X-Files meets The Odd Couple, because even within that weird, like, parameters of the play, a supernatural act happens. So I still think it's a very funny. That's what basically got us our first attention when we lived in New York.
Now, is the writing process that you went through for Matt and Ben, is that something similar to what you use when you write for The Office now? Because in the book, you write that it was really organic in terms of just batting around ideas with your friend Brenda about, you know, what would Matt say, what would Ben say. Is that something that you do today when you write for The Office?
It was absolutely the same, because what it was the reason why being a comedy writer is the best job in the world, is that you're just sitting in a room with eight people, most of whom are your friends, and you're just like messing around, and you, there's a snack room adjacent, and someone is there writing down everything. So it's very focused joking around, and you're allowed to go on tangents and talk about what movie you hated over the weekend and which actress is overrated, and you can have all that stuff as part of the process. Like, you're allowed to do that. NBC pays you to do that. And then you come back and you start talking about, well, this is the prank that Dwight should do on Jim. And that was what happened with me and Brenda when we were writing Matt and Ben, except instead of it being Jim and Pam, it was Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, two actors we didn't know and didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm. If we could take a step back, there's a lot I want to talk to you about The Office.
I love this. This is my most favorite thing I've ever done.
About working at The Office.
No, talking about myself. Okay. Including working at The Office.
Well, I wonder about the character of Kelly Kapoor. When we started talking about her, how do you think she's evolved over time?
Well, to be frank, I think I've become a better actor. So I think that has helped the character just be nuanced. I think that can't help but happen when the actor gets better. I think in the first couple seasons, definitely, I had this thing of me being like, I can't believe they're letting me act. And you can see that on this. You can see, like, Mindy Kaling, the person in Kelly Kapoor's costume, like, being like, oh, my God, this is really happening. So I think that is gone. So I feel just more confident playing the character.
Is there a way that the character of Kelly has changed that you didn't anticipate?
No, I would say there's not. I mean, I talk about how on a comedy show, one of the things that can happen to actors, and I love actors, but this can happen because you want to do the very best job you can acting, is you want your character to become very three-dimensionalized, which is great. However, on a show that has like 18 characters on The Office, if every character on the show was going to become three-dimensionalized, for some characters like Steve Carell's character Michael, we wanted him to, because we wanted people to root for him, not just be like, oh my God, he's so embarrassing. But if every other small tertiary character is wanting to have a huge backstory about, you know, everything going on in their life, the show becomes like 30 something, and it's like you can't laugh at anyone because no one is just being like a jerk or kind of slutty or drinking too much or mean. It's all like, well, they're being mean because of what happened to them. And like, you know, the thing about Kelly, I will say, is that I haven't really wanted her to be this character who we see. Well, why did she become so shallow? What's moving her to do that? Because I think it makes the show less interesting.
Mindy Kaling played Kelly Kapoor on The Office. We spoke with her in 2011 about her book, Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? And Other Concerns. Her latest book is called Why Not Me? The Cambridge native is also creator and star of The Mindy Project. When we come back, Kelly's bad boyfriend and Mindy Kaling's favorite writer, BJ Novak.
Do you want me to do more push-ups?
Yeah.
Okay, you have to break up with Daryl. I already typed out a text message for you.
I don't know. I mean, it's well written and all. It just...
has to be done. We'll press send together.
My God, he's gonna kill us.
I'd like to see him try.
He says it's cool.
Didn't you two date for like a long time?
This is like a fairy tale.
Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's a new year, so what better way to celebrate than to listen back to some old conversations? No, seriously, this is actually a terrific hour where we're revisiting conversations we had with cast members of the Emmy Award-winning NBC comedy The Office. Now, before the break, we heard from Mindy Kaling, who played the bubbly Kelly Kapoor. In Kaling's most recent book, Why Not Me?, she describes fellow Office actor BJ Novak as her soup snake. That's a term from the show itself, coined by Dunder Mifflin manager Michael Scott, played, of course, by Steve Carell.
You and I are soup snakes. And the reason is because in terms of the soup we like to eat, that doesn't make any sense. We're soulmates.
Soulmates is what you aim for, Mindy writes of BJ Novak in her book, but soup snakes is what you get sometimes. Novak is a Newton native and a Harvard grad. He's got writer, director, and executive producer credits on The Office, as well as playing Ryan Howard.
Yeah, I'm not a temp anymore. I got Jim's old job, which means at my 10-year high school reunion, it will not say Ryan Howard is a temp. It will say Ryan Howard is a junior sales associate at a mid-range paper supply firm. That'll show him.
BJ Novak published his fiction debut in 2014. It's called One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. And when he spoke to Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks, Novak began by reading one of those stories.
My dad likes this one a lot. This is a very short piece. It's called Confucius at Home. I'm hungry, said Confucius to a nearby servant. Is there any food around? Some noodles, maybe?
Confucius say, bring noodles, shouted the servant to the cook.
Hey, please calm down, said Confucius. It's just a question, only if it's convenient.
Confucius say, calm down, shouted the servant to the rest of the household.
Stop it, okay? Snapped Confucius. Not everything is a thing.
Confucius say, not everything is a thing.
Damn it, thought Confucius, and he was about to interrupt him again, but didn't. That one sounded pretty good, he had to admit. And the one before wasn't so bad either, if interpreted in the right way. You get those last two? Confucius whispered to his scribe, who was sitting in the corner. Calm down, and the other one? The scribe nodded. I don't know, maybe, Confucius shrugged. Not the noodles one, obviously. But if the scribe wanted to write those other two down, well, Confucius wasn't going to stop him.
That's great. It's got to be tough being Confucius, you know?
Yeah.
Everything you say.
And yet, it's got to be tempting, too. Well, that doesn't sound so bad. I wouldn't mind if students studied that for the next 1,000 years.
So I was intrigued to read. We mentioned that you have a background in stand-up comedy, and you actually road tested these in a comedy club, right?
Yeah, that was the first time I did. It was at the Improv in L.A., and I got on stage as part of a longer night. I think it was after Dane Cook. I mean, it was a real comedy night. And I said, I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to read a couple short stories. And people laughed, thinking it was a joke on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I took out some paper and read some stories. And I held their attention enough and got enough laughs to think this is something I could do.
Interesting. But I'm curious why you wanted to do it that way. I mean, why road test the stories in a comedy club? Because we don't often think of stories needing to pass that test.
Well, I think we should, or at least I wanted to write stories that pass that test. I did my best writing as a stand-up, or I really got to a new level, I felt, as a stand-up and then on The Office, when I was really called out, I felt, on anything that didn't work by the fact of seeing it not work.
Yeah.
And it's very different to write something in a college class and have everyone tell you, brilliant, they don't get you, but I do, and for you to tell yourself that.
Yeah.
But when you're standing in front of an audience and people don't get it, it feels bad. And it should feel bad, I mean, unless you really believe in it. But
yeah.
you should be challenged, because I write for the reader.
Yeah.
And I, you know, wrote TV for the viewer, and it didn't matter how brilliant I thought I was. It mattered how funny it felt. So I thought that was the hardest test, and that if I was really serious about this, I would subject myself to the hardest test I could.
In your book, One More Thing, you thank the people who attended these readings, and you wrote, "I loved you and feared you." I'd love to. What was that process like? So there was obviously an element of fear.
Yeah, I actually did my best. After that comedy club, I mainly did it at the UCB Theater in LA, and I'd announce those shows once a month, and called Uncollected Stories, and people would come, and there'd be about 100 people to hear brand new stories. And the hours before each show were the most euphoric and scary hours that I've ever had as a performer, because I knew I was about to bring up the writing I cared most about, and I'd have no option to really kind of change it on the fly the way you can in stand-up comedy. I was locked in. And so my best writing, actually my best revisions, were not done on stage or after stage. The best revisions were done the few hours before stage, when I was terrified and excited.
Fueled about, by the terror.
Exactly. Yeah. I thought, I can't read this paragraph. This isn't ready. Right. Or this piece is boring. They won't like it, and I'll agree with them. And then other times I think, oh, that's funny. Could I get one more laugh after that? Yeah. You know, just selfishly. So that was, I really meant it. I loved and feared the audience, and I wanted to do right by them.
Well, could I have you read another? I'd love you if you could just read the beginning of The Man Who Invented the Calendar. It's a great piece. This also was a Shouts and Murmur a little while ago in The New Yorker.
Happy to.
Yeah, read us that
one. The Man Who Invented the Calendar. January 1st. Ha, that feels fun to write. I'm excited. I've been thinking about doing this for so long, too. I went through all my old diaries, and it turns out I came up with this idea all the way back on day after day after very cloudy day. January 2nd. I'm still so excited about this calendar thing. It just makes so much sense. 1,000 days a year, divided into 25 months, 40 days a month. Why didn't anyone think of this before? January 3rd. Getting so many compliments on the calendar. One guy came up to me today and said he's going to organize his whole life around it. Literally, someone said that. January 4th, best day ever, or at least so far in recorded history. I was talking to Alice at the bonfire for such a long time. Yes, that Alice. It seemed like she was into me, but I didn't want to be presumptuous. Finally, I asked if she wanted to come back to my place and hang out more. She winked at me and said, I don't know. I guess I'll have to check my calendar. January 30th. People really hate January and want it to be over right away. I tried to explain that it's just the way we choose to label things, and it wouldn't make any difference, but no one got it. Finally, I just told everyone that this would be the last day of January and months would just be 30 days instead of 40. But there wasn't enough time to get the word out, so to be safe, we have to make this month 31 days, and then we'll make the rest 30. Not a big deal. Everyone is excited to see February, including me. February 1st. Another small screw-up. I put an extra R in all the copies I hand out of the calendar, so it said February, even though I already told everyone the next month coming up was called February. I felt so stupid. But Alice came up with the best solution. She said, just tell everyone it's spelled February, but pronounced February. That way, they'll feel stupid. Alice is the best.
That's great. That's B.J. Novak reading a story, The Man Who Invented the Calendar. It's from his book of stories and other stories called One More Thing. B.J. Novak, of course, actor, stand-up comedian, screenwriter, and director. He was the writer and co-executive producer and an actor in The Office, the long-running hit series on NBC, which we're going to talk about in a bit. There's such a wide range of stories in this book, from a man who purchases a sex robot to a woman who goes on a blind date with an African warlord. Where do these ideas come from?
These ideas were all, or at least at the beginning, were all ideas that I had as a writer over 8 years on The Office that just did not fit for Jim and Pam and Dwight and Creed. A lot of stuff fit for Creed. I suppose he could have done a lot of those things. But in general, I loved these ideas, but I could not work them into episodes. And I kept track of them all in pocket notebooks that I kept. And when the show ended, I sort of thought, well, there must be a screenplay or a TV show. And there's notebooks, and there wasn't. It was more like 1,000 different opening shots. And I had the idea, I loved them all. I didn't want to give up any of these ideas, but they didn't all fit together. So I thought, what if I wrote each one out just as an exercise? I wrote them all out and just tried to be true to each one. So if one story ends up sad, it's a sad story. If one story is four lines, it's a four-line piece. And that really liberated me to write a tremendous amount. And then once I got in that role, everything, everything I overheard in conversation, every heartbreak I was a party to, everything became sort of a short story based around some observation that I found unusual and funny in some way, but not always in a direct way.
And where does writing fit into all of your many talents? I mean, actor, writer, producer, you've done so much already. Is this the thing?
I mean... Well, this is the thing. This has always been the thing, I think, and everything for me comes out of that. If I am acting, it's because I really get the script. I know how to be true to that script. Mm-hmm. And if I'm directing, it's usually because I wrote something and want to show people what I meant. But at the root of everything I do, it's always the mind of a writer specifically.
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about The Office, which provided a big break for you, of course. And let me ask you about your character. You play Ryan Howard. You played Ryan Howard, who's the temp. And let's listen to just a brief clip from The Office. Here's B.J. Novak playing Ryan Howard.
Woof is a site that I'm launching to be the last word in social networking. For just $12.99 a month, Woof links up all your communication portals so you are always within reach. It's part of the dog pack, as I call it. But look, why tell you when I can show you? I just sent myself a Woof.
Ryan, you have a Woof on line one.
Thank you, Aaron. Woof.
Woof. The dog pack. A brilliant idea. I can't believe that didn't make its way into the marketplace.
I have a friend who works at Google, and he said that sometimes an idea is shot down as sounding too much like woof. So I know it's made its way into the culture that way.
So tell me about the character, Ryan. He's often, you know, every time I read about him, he's sort of referred to as the annoyingly snooty temp. How did you think about him?
He is desperately trying to validate himself, desperately trying to be important, and always failing. So he's always trying, and he's a smart guy, but he doesn't have great character, and he's not very grounded. So he's always trying new schemes to be important. And at one point, he's a very successful executive until he falls from grace. Another time, he tries to be a tech guru. He tries to reinvent himself culturally as a sort of hipster Occupy Wall Street type. He goes through a lot of phases. He never finds himself.
So I have to ask you about this transition from doing stand-up to becoming involved with this fabulously successful TV show. When you were sort of plucked out of the world of stand-up to go do this show, did you know it was going to be, did you have any idea that it was going to be as successful as
it was? I did, and that was an unusual point of view to have then, because it was a remake of a British show.
Right.
It was very slow. It was very quiet. And
the British show, you mean?
The British show and the show we were making.
Yeah.
It really did not seem like the colorful, bright, studio audience laughter type of show that was a hit. I thought it would be a hit because I would go to the gym every day and they'd play The Simpsons on a screen on silent. And I'd notice I would watch The Simpsons even not hearing any dialogue because the characters are clear. Mm-hmm. You see Homer, you know who he is. You see Bart. I felt, you know, am I crazy or is this show like that? You see Michael, you see the guy, you see the girl, you see the weirdo, you see the boss. It just everyone's super clear, and I think that is the secret weapon of shows that succeed, is that you can watch them even with the sound off.
You know, I'm almost embarrassed to admit this. When you mention it's a remake of a British show, of course it was. It was the Ricky Gervais show, and which I loved when I first saw
it. Yeah, me too.
And when you guys started, I thought, no way they're going to be able to sort of compete with that. And yet I think this is one of the rare remakes that really even surpass the original model. And when I go back and look at what Ricky Gervais was doing, there's almost a kind of, I don't want to say meanness, but there's an edginess.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
There's sort of a meanness that you guys didn't have.
Yeah, and you could also say that they're better at expressing that side of life, which they are. Yeah. And what we did was really center on a character who had a lot, Michael Scott, Steve Carell's character, had a lot more love for life and was maybe a little more naive, a lot more naive. Yeah. That Ricky Gervais's character is quite intelligent, and it comes out in negative ways a lot, in addition to his character flaws. Michael's character is much more pure of heart, and I think that was more appealing over time and allowed us to do stories that people connected to a lot more. I wouldn't say it's better. I'd say we did a different thing better, and they did something that we didn't do.
Yeah. Speaking of Steve Carell, I mean, he had so much to do with the success of that show, and yet when he left, it still worked really well. So what was it that worked so well on that show? I mean, how do you think about it?
The characters were all really great. They were well-defined. You felt like you knew them. Greg Daniels, who created the show, had a 5% rule. He said, characters should constantly surprise you by 5%. If a character does the opposite of what they would ever do, you don't buy it. And if they do the same thing they always do, it's not interesting. You should always learn some new detail. That's interesting. That Dwight's into that.
For example.
What's interesting? Well, when Jim was discovered to have a secret life on a chat board, or a second life it was called, where he is a sports reporter in Philadelphia. That's a very dorky thing about a very cool guy. And yet, okay, I got it. He wasn't pretending he was an astronaut. I can see that about him. And it was a fun, embarrassing revelation.
Yeah. Now, what kind of sort of leeway did you have? I mean, you guys were handed a script, but I understand you had a certain amount of, you were encouraged to apply a certain amount of leeway to developing these characters, right?
As writers, you mean?
Yeah. Well, as actors, too.
Oh, as actors, yeah. It was a very organic divide between, or lack of divide between the writers and actors. And that's what Greg told me when he hired me as a writer-actor. He said, I want to try this experiment where we all feel like the same gang, where the writers are acting and the actors are writing and everyone's directing and we're all kind of making it together. It shouldn't feel like a corporate show. It should feel more like a comedy troupe.
That's BJ Novak speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks back in 2014 about his fiction debut, One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. Novak was a writer, director, and executive producer on The Office. He also played Ryan Howard, who famously nearly burned down the Dunder Mifflin office.
Ryan started the fire! It was always burning! Everybody
was turning!
Ryan, Megan, Melly Moore, Ryan, Rollins, Ronald, now Marilyn Monroe!
When we come back, your favorite office bully, Dwight Schrute.
How would I describe myself? Three words. Hardworking, alpha male, jackhammer, merciless, insatiable.
We'll talk with Rainn Wilson, perhaps the most surprising office actor of all. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're kicking off 2016 by revisiting some of the conversations we've had with actors from the beloved NBC series, The Office. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, many of them have Massachusetts roots, and many of them have surprisingly personal stories about how they landed in the long-running Emmy Award-winning show. Most surprising of all, Rainn Wilson, who played, with deliciously weird wickedness, office bully Dwight Schrute.
People say, oh, it's dangerous to keep weapons in the home or the workplace. Well, I say, it's better to be hurt by someone you know accidentally than by a stranger on purpose.
That's the Dwight we all know and love. And yet, BJ Novak describes actor Rainn Wilson as more grounded, warm, thoughtful, and articulate than you'd ever imagine. The reason why is made evident in Wilson's new memoir, The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. It is a fascinating read. Hollywood is the high temple for modern-day celebrity worship, and so it surprised me to discover that Wilson is a deeply committed member of the Baha'i faith. He's also strongly connected to his parents, despite, as he writes, their bizarre failures and absences in his life. Which is why, when we talked with Rainn Wilson a couple of months ago, I began by telling him that his memoir really felt like an ode to love.
Wow, an ode to love, like Proust, kind of?
Look, you're a man who quotes Rilke in the first chapter.
Yeah, I do. I have a lot of pretentious quotes in there. That's really interesting. I'm going to think about that, An Ode to Love. Yeah, there's a lot of exploration in this. You know, when I pitched the book, I said, listen, there's going to be some stuff that's going to be spiritual in here, and I'm going to strive for some profundity, and I've got to share some deep, dark truths about my life and, you know, and a lot of, you know, warts and all kind of stuff, and make myself really vulnerable, and there's going to be some big ideas in it, and the publishers weren't scared. So, you know, I don't know that I succeeded, but I swung for the fences on this one because I wanted it to be really funny, but I also wanted it to be as profound as I could make it.
Okay, well, I'd love to sort of share in detail with listeners the sense of that profundity, because I'm sure they're probably sitting here, those people who don't know your story are sitting here thinking, wait, this guy plays Dwight on The Office, and we're talking about profound spirituality, but it's true. So can you read a little section of your book? Because
sure.
I would love to hear you tell this story. And it has to do when you went to Tufts.
Yep.
And this was a moment of divine inspiration that you had, because you weren't quite sure what you wanted to do with your life. But you say that you had a mystical experience when you went to go watch A Chorus Line at a government center multiplex. So can you tell us a little bit of that story, and then read to us the moment of divine inspiration?
Yeah, I was trying to decide whether to become an actor or not. And really, like, because I knew, because my dad was a failed artist, and he'd wanted to paint and he wanted to write, and never worked out for him. I knew that if you wanted to be a professional artist, I didn't know any professional artists, but I imagined that you would have to devote 10, 15, 20 years to it, that you have to dive in completely. And that was a very scary thing for me at 19 years old. And I was trying to decide whether to go to India with my friend who was going to go travel for a year, or to go to acting school, maybe go to New York and really, like, dive into the whole acting thing. I didn't know what to do. And my decision was kind of made for me seeing this matinee of A Chorus Line right here in Boston.
Okay, so read to us what happened.
All right. Sitting by myself in the dark of a near-empty matinee in a theater near Government Center, Boston, I started to ugly cry. This is while watching the film. Full-on, grotesque, racking sobs during What I Did for Love, the kind where you're sort of gulping for air. As all these actors and singers and dancers were longing and yearning to act and sing and dance, I felt a kinship in my heart which lunged towards the screen as if it would burst. I stepped out of the theater, tears drying on my cheeks, into one of the most beautiful sunsets I'd ever seen. Red and orange light was streaming through snowflakes that had begun to quietly fall from the Boston sky. The ground, the multiplex, the high-spired churches and offices of that great city were being dusted with white, and time, once again, seemed to slow down and stop like a train pulling into a station. I gazed up into the sky and took several deep breaths, noticing that a deeply calm, passionate decision seemed to be dropping down into my body. I decided to go for it. I knew I had to become an actor. There was no turning back. It was my calling, my vocation. The entire course of my life changed outside of a multiplex during Christmas of 1985 after viewing one of the worst movies of the 1980s. True story.
That's actor Rainn Wilson reading from his memoir, The Bassoon King. When I got to that page, I just thought, we have to have him read this, because this is one of the moments that you talk about in the book of letting yourself accept some kind of divine inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Did it feel divine at the time?
You know, there's several of these moments. It's an interesting exercise to write one's memoir. I firmly believe everyone should do it, because it gives you an incredibly valuable perspective. And you look back on my 49 years and I see these waypoints, these little special little hinge moments that without which I wouldn't have the life that I have. It all adds up to something, but there are these turning points. Did they feel divine at the time? I don't know. Sometimes. They certainly didn't seem as profound as, looking back on them, I realize they were.
Well, so I keep mentioning divinity, but we should explain that you're a member of the Baha'i faith.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have been since you were born, right?
Yeah, my
But you've come in and out of it, though.
Exactly. My parents were Baha'is. I grew up Baha'i, was raised Baha'i, and was very into it as a kid and as a teen. And it was great because I learned all these wonderful teachings of the Baha'i faith, the equality of men and women and the unity of the races of humanity, the essential harmony of the world's religions, the harmony of science and religion, you know, these great teachings. But when I moved to New York City to become an actor, like right after what I just read there, I rejected it all. And I didn't want anything to do with faith, religion, God, morality. And it was about 12 years I was really outside of the Baha'i faith or any faith. And so a big through line in the book is my spiritual journey and finding my way back to the Baha'i faith.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the portion where you, when you rejected it all, I mean, that part actually kind of reads like a classic Hollywood fall from grace almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, cocaine played a role.
Yeah. It's like any VH1 Behind the Music, you know, when the band falls apart after their initial success.
Yeah.
I hadn't even had any success and I fell apart. Yeah. I went off the rails in a lot of different ways back then. Yeah. And it wasn't like hardcore. It's not like, oh, I was this heroin addict. And it's not that story. It's not that kind of total addiction story. But it was, you know, I got lost in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's go back even further, if we could, to when you grew up, when you were really, really young, growing up in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that part spoke to me, too, because I grew up in Oregon. I'm a native Northwesterner.
Nice.
As well. Although I've been living here in Boston for a while, so I don't know what that makes me. But your parents weren't exactly down the middle, conventional 1960s, 70s parents, were they?
No, they weren't. My mom wanted to name me Thucydides after the Greek historian. My dad wanted to name me Rainer after Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet. And they lived on a houseboat in Seattle, very bohemian kind of lifestyle, painting murals. And my mom was actually an actress in experimental theater in Seattle in the late 60s, and I think did a play where she kind of infamously ran around painted blue and topless and naked, which really wasn't done much in those days. And yeah, it was a very odd upbringing. After she left, my parents got a divorce, and I ended up living in Nicaragua for several mm-hmm. years on the Caribbean coast and had a lot of crazy misadventures there. So, you know, the long story short of it, looking back on it, is I'm a kind of an odd dude, but I really have played all these outsider characters that are alienated, kind of misfits. And because I relate to that so much. I really was an alienated misfit in so many different ways growing up.
Right. So, I mean, there's and it's your parents' sort of approach to the world didn't come out of anywhere, didn't come out of nowhere either. I mean, because you write how your mother's mother died.
Yeah.
and her father was a farmer, and so she spent a lot of time growing up with chickens and pigs, like,
yeah,
while her dad was off working on the farm. And
yeah,
then your father's mother died because she was in a sanatorium and she was going to visit her kids. But
it's the most tragic story I've ever heard in my life.
Hit her head and just died.
She had tuberculosis. She got better from tuberculosis. She had been in a sanatorium for years. And my dad was like 9 years old, and they went to go pick her up to take her home. And she ran over to see them out the window in the courtyard. And then she ran to go get her coat and leave and fell down and hit her head on a radiator and died. Just like that.
And your dad was what, 8?
I think he was 8 or 9 years old.
And yeah, you write that he sort of sits at the table afterwards and asks his father, who's going to take care of me now?
Yeah, yeah, who's going to take care of me now?
And that's what it all comes down to.
That's the line, isn't it?
So I'm asking you about all of this. We're doing this like therapy session here because
I know this is very deep. I love it.
Well,
this is good.
You're the one who gave me the material
all right
in the book.
But, fair enough.
Because, you know, I keep having to remind myself as I was reading this. This is the guy who is a world famous actor who plays a character or played a character on TV for a couple hundred episodes. That's like the opposite of uh-huh all of this, you know.
But I can be a big fat jerk face too. Just watch. Just wait. Ask my wife.
We have 6.5 more minutes for you to prove that here. Okay. Not that I'm challenging you to do that. But were there parts of this sort of unorthodox upbringing that did make its way into Dwight, the character?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the reminiscences that I have, I don't even think I talked about it in the book so much, is I have this realization that because things were so odd in my family, with my stepmom who kind of raised me and my dad and my birth mother, that I didn't know how normal people acted. So I spent a lot of time in my childhood and in my teens trying to figure out how normal people related to one another. It was this kind of very kind of oddly detached, almost like how an android would kind of be watching human beings, or an alien posing as a human being, like, oh, these people are friends and they're happy. Oh, and look, and they hug in a carefree, jovial way, and they embrace and they laugh. And
does not compute.
Yeah. No, I would take notes and be like, oh, that's what I should do. Next time I would see someone I like, I would try and laugh jovially and embrace in a similar way that I saw other people do it, because my family was so odd that I, you know. So it does relate to Dwight. I mean, because Dwight kind of does that too. He doesn't obey the rule. There's the Schrute rules of human interaction are very, very different than the normal cultural rules of human interaction.
Hmm. But on the other hand, you know, you did write in the book that it was really interesting for you that you go from, I mean, you write about how in your teen years you are like a classic nerd, right? The bassoon playing, the chess club.
Mm-hmm. Chess team, baby.
Chess
we competed.
Team. Playing the bassoon because your teacher told you it would be better than playing the saxophone. All these things that make you a card-carrying nerd.
Yep, Dungeons and Dragons, sure.
Of course, we had to get the role-playing in there. But you write that you go from being that to a couple decades later being this, like, hero, this nerd hero. And in the book you say it's an exhilarating, that realization was exhilarating and incredibly challenging at the same time.
Yeah.
So the challenging part.
Yeah, so for someone who always considered themselves an outsider and kind of a weirdo, and I was just trying to make it as a character actor, and all of a sudden to just, like, wherever I went, people would be like, oh, my God, look, it's Dwight. Oh, hey, it's Dwight. I love you. Oh, my God, you're so funny. Can I have my picture? You're amazing. Oh, you know, to get that, like, wherever I go, right? Not wherever, but a lot of places where I go, and especially back when the show was on the air, is pretty weird. It's a very strange, and it's like it's exciting. You know, I'd worked for 14 years as a professional actor before I did The Office. Hardly ever got recognized ever, and then to kind of be put on this weird pedestal was pretty astonishing and it's challenging. Why? Because, man, it's so easy to get entitled. It's so easy. The human ego is a very insidious creature inside of us that wants attention and accolade and status. And there's a constant wrestling with ourselves we have to do. And when everyone is just giving you everything, just like, here's free stuff. Or here, do you want a free trip? And we love you wherever you go. Like, you start to believe the hype. And it's not like I was like this raging jerk face. But, well, sometimes I was. But it shifts your perspective in these insidious ways,
right.
Fame and entitlement.
And celebrity, yeah. And that, I mean, Hollywood, yeah. you use the phrase spiritually questionable, right? I mean.
Yeah. And so it's been a struggle, you know? That's been a battle. And think about, you know, the Justin Biebers of the world, or the people that are just that get instantly famous and they're like 16 and the entire world is giving them on a platter.
Yeah.
You know, I have to constantly remind myself, like, look, I'm just this dorky Dungeons and Dragons playing actor from Seattle, and I happened to get lucky and get on this one TV show that got hot for a while.
Well, it was more than luck, because obviously your skill as an actor helped a great deal. But we've got like 30 seconds left, and I do just...
What?
I know, it goes by fast, but I do want to just read a little bit from the last chapter of your book, because your spirituality and your faith play such a huge role here. The last chapter is 10 Things I Know for Sure. And it starts with number one, the deepest happiness comes from service to others, to number 10, which is, I still don't know anything.
True.
After all that time. Still don't know anything.
Yeah. I'm gonna start over. I'm gonna write my next memoir for the next 50 years. Maybe I'll learn something.
Well, we'll have you back hopefully before 50 years goes by.
Okay. That's bassoon and playing in the background.
Yes, it is.
Oh, you did that for me.
We think about it all, actually. Rainn Wilson is best known for his Emmy Award-nominated role as Dwight Schrute on NBC's The Office. We spoke with him just a couple of months ago about his memoir, The Bassoon King, My Life in Art, Faith, and Idiocy. Well, that's it for today's special hour, listening back to some of our favorite conversations with actors from The Office. Before we go, I want to end with a bit of tape that we started the hour with. This little nugget from Pam Beasley.
I think an ordinary paper company like Dunder Mifflin was a great subject for a documentary. There's a lot of beauty in ordinary things.
You know, it's true. And hey, I can be as syrupy as Pam at times. So I hope you find at least a little bit of that beauty when you head back to your ordinary things next week. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy New Year. This is Radio Boston.